And we are already at the top of the hour, so I want to introduce our three speakers today. Speaking first, we have Dr. Amy Cohen. She's a health services researcher at VA Desert Pacific MIREC and VA HSR&D Center for the Study of Healthcare Innovation, Implementation, and Policy at the VA Greater Los Angeles Healthcare System. Speaking second, we have Mona Ritchie. She's a PhD candidate, and she is the Co-Implementation Research Coordinator at VA Mental Health Query. And finally, we will have Dr. Allison Hamilton. She is a research health scientist and the Director of Qualitative Methods Group at the VA HSR&D Study for the Health Center for the Study of Healthcare Innovation, Implementation, and Policy, also at the VA Greater Los Angeles Healthcare System. So at this time, Dr. Cohen, are you ready to share your screen? Okay, you should have the pop-up now, and we're good to go.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for the kind introduction. We're going to be speaking today about improving care quality through hybrid implementation effectiveness studies, including best practices in design, methods, and measures. Now, in hybrid designs, you have a dual focus on effectiveness and implementation. The attention or weight of each of these is decided a priori. So I want you to look on the left side of your screen, the hybrid one. These have a primary aim of testing the clinical intervention and a secondary aim of observing or gathering information on implementation. In a hybrid type 2 study, you have co-primary aims, where you have equal weight to test the clinical intervention and study the implementation intervention. In a hybrid type 3, the primary aim is to test the implementation intervention, and secondary is to look or gather information about the clinical intervention and outcomes. Today, we're going to bring these hybrid designs to life for you through three example studies. The presentation order reflects the growth in knowledge both at the researcher and study reviewer levels regarding implementation science. If you notice, on my study, we started work in July 2005. Mona's study started in 2009, and Allison, who will be speaking third, her study started in 2012 and is ongoing. You'll notice that our three study designs, both Allison and I will be presenting hybrid types two studies, while Mona will present a hybrid type 3 studies. And we're going to have the opportunity across our three studies to talk about five different conceptual models. Our settings and study targets are very different. As you can see, they range from specialty mental health to primary care to community-based service organizations with different populations. And we all three used mixed methods in our studies. We'd like to start with a poll question. Which of these topics would you like most to learn about?
Thank you. So our attendees, you can see the poll question is up on your screen at this time. Just click the circle next to your answer. So once again, the question is, which of these topics would you most like to learn about? The answer options are hybrid study designs, implementation strategies, conceptual models, and evaluation methods. And it looks like we've got a very responsive group. We've already had over 73% votes, and the answers are still coming in. So we'll give people a little bit more time. Okay, it looks like we've capped off right around 80% response rate. I'm going to go ahead and close the poll and share the results. So as you can see, we have 35% interested in hybrid study designs, 26% implementation strategies, 15% conceptual models, and 24% evaluation methods. Thank you to our respondents.
Wonderful. So it sounds like a lot of the group wants to hear about the design, the strategies, and how to evaluate those, and we'll hopefully cover that. We'll leave a little time at the end if we don't get to your specific question about one of those areas. So I'm actually going to begin by talking about improving care quality, especially mental health, using a hybrid type 2 design. So in specialty mental health, the hallmark disorder is schizophrenia, and it is found in 1% of the population and accounts for 10% of all permanently disabled people. This population dies on average about 11 to 17 years prematurely, mostly due to heart disease. Now, the good news is evidence-based practices exist, including social skills training, family services, weight management programs, supported employment, helping these people get to a full recovery. But unfortunately, these are not available in all settings, or when they're available, they're severely underutilized by this population. And therefore, we see outcomes much worse than we would expect after reading efficacy studies. I'm going to talk about our EQUIP study, which stands for Enhancing Quality of Care in Psychosis. The primary support for our study was VA HSR&D query. Again, because it's a hybrid type 2 design, we have co-primary aims. The intervention that we were supporting was a chronic care model, including support of evidence-based practices, and we examined patient-level data to assess the intervention's effectiveness. For the implementation aim, we used evidence-based quality improvement tools and strategies, and here we examined patient, provider, and organizational level data to assess if the implementation process and outcomes were effective. We used the evaluation data from the implementation aspects of this study to optimize implementation throughout. So to address the 35% who want to know a little bit more about the hybrid design, I want to talk about, and each of us are going to talk about, why we decided on a hybrid type 2 and not a hybrid type 1 or type 3 for this study. Well, we knew evidence-based practices existed from efficacy studies. And prior to this study, no multi-site studies had substantially improved the quality of care for schizophrenia within the context of usual care, of effectiveness studies. So we knew that we needed more work here. We also knew there were barriers and facilitators to those services from our own previous type 1 study, and we needed to study an implementation approach to increase the uptake of evidence-based practices. And thus, we needed a hybrid type 2 so that we could focus equally on simultaneously on effectiveness and implementation. So EQUIP was a clinic-level controlled trial involving 801 patients with schizophrenia and 201 clinicians. We promoted and supported a research and regional leadership partnership. This was a process with regional and local medical centers and clinic leadership. We involved one intervention and one control site in each of four visits for a total of 8 medical centers. And we did strategic planning to choose which evidence-based practices could be addressed. So we gave each site a menu of evidence-based practice options that we thought we could support and let them choose two. And as I've spoken about in previous cyber seminars, everyone chose the same two evidence-based practices, that is targeting weight and employment. And I think at the time and even today, these were both considered high priority areas for this population. We did quantitative assessments and qualitative assessments. Now, again, our specific aims were two co-primary aims. First, looking at the chronic care model as the intervention, and then looking at evidence-based quality improvement strategies and tools for the implementation. It was important to us to have a theory of organizational change driving the design of the implementation research. Though informed by more than one conceptual framework, EQUIP is organized around the Simpson Transfer Model, which models stages of organizational change. Now, we supplemented the Simpson Transfer Model with the PRECEDE Model, which stands for predisposing, reinforcing, and enabling factors in diagnosis and evaluation. Now, we really felt we needed this because we need specific behavior change concepts to move the organization through the change. And we needed active participation of the targeted audience. So active strategies and PRECEDE include things like consulting with clinical experts, patient screening technologies so we know where the patients are and what they need, clinical reminders, and incentives to reinforce behavior change. Now, the Simpson transfer model in its early iteration incorporates the notion of readiness to change at both the individual and the organizational level. It's a program change model for transferring research into practice. Now, the model involves four processes or four action stages that guide the transfer. So in the first one, you educate and expose the group to the new practice. Then you move to adoption, where there's an intention to try through leadership decisions and support of the group. And then implementation is exploratory use of the new practice, and then practice is routine use. But crucial to the successful movement through the stages is readiness to change and organizational dynamics, or the climate and the staff attributes. We really spent a lot of time on readiness in the study to try to tailor the training and exposure at each site. Now, just as the intervention, the chronic care model, is supported by evidence, the best way to implement that intervention is also based in an evidence base. So we use the evidence base from evidence-based quality improvement, and this incorporates a research and clinical partnership, which I already discussed, uses top-down and bottom-up features to engage the organizational leaders and quality improvement teams, and focuses on prior research evidence around clinical guidelines, care models, and clinical behavior change methods. Again, our overall goal is to translate research on care delivery models into routine practice. Now, in terms of the implementation strategy, we really had to make that into something that was measurable. And so we broke up the evidence-based quality improvement strategies and tools into these different areas, which you'll see on this slide. So leadership support included release time, a verbal decision from them to adopt, which was communicated to the teams, a clinical champion at the site, and here we had actually people nominate themselves rather than us choosing someone. These people then addressed provider attitudes, provider education, and helped when benchmarks came out to help interpret how they might meet those. A quality manager who did patient education and care coordination. We used informatics to help with decision support and to help educate and help patients advocate for the services that they needed, and we gave routine performance feedback. We lined up the Simpson transfer model with our evaluation. So as you can see, you see on that second line here where the Simpson transfer model four stages line up with what we measured. And so in the first stage, we had weekly field notes. We took minutes on calls. We had monthly calls with every site. We measured readiness, and we did key stakeholder interviews. Then, while implementation was going, we had a PhD at the site taking field notes every week, and then the care manager, who was the quality coordinator, kept a log about how she spent her time and what was going on, where she was having barriers. We had documents and minutes. And the QI tools were really a patient-facing kiosk that gathered patients' information from patients about how the implementation was going. Then we also had EBQI teams at each site who also met regularly and fed back information to the research team about the context of quality improvement and how that was going. And lastly, during post-implementation, we continued to gather field notes, and then we repeated the readiness and burnout inventories. So by gathering data from multiple clinical and organizational sources and at multiple time points, we gained confidence in the picture of what was needed to implement the intervention and to close the gaps in care quality. Now, the project is finished, and it was quite successful. In terms of implementation, we increased utilization of work services and wait services by 2.3 times. We also had significant gains in the intervention in terms of its effectiveness. The weight program showed considerable weight loss at 12 months in the intervention site, and many people were engaged in looking for work, although not many people had competitive jobs, an outcome that we consider more distal. So what did we learn? What were the necessary components to get to that success? Well, we really felt it was important to have a multidisciplinary research team, including clinicians, social scientists, and administrators, good communication in those early relationship building period, a conceptual model to guide the project, the idea of working with local priorities. Remember I talked about that menu of choices we gave the sites, really to get their buy-in on what we could change. Assessing readiness and then tailoring the intervention based on how ready each site was. And then have a flexible implementation strategy, those EBQI strategies and tools that I showed earlier. So hybrid type 2 studies take a lot of staff, and so to rigorously examine both aims, and I really just wanted to recognize those people here who made this study so successful. And I'm going to turn it over to Mana.
Mana, you may still be on mute, so check your microphone. Okay, it seems we're having some audio issues with Mana. Mana, if you can hear me, you may want to disconnect your microphone and try calling into the toll number. So thank you, everyone, for your patience. These are the flukes of using technology to run these virtual seminars. We do have control over most things, but glitches do pop up. So I'm just going to... So please just hold on and give us your patience. And Amy, if there's anything you want to continue on adding, feel free while we get through to her.
If we have to, Molly, I can go while we're trying to get Mana on.
Okay, yeah, how about we go ahead and do that, and I'll work with her offline to see if we can get her back in.
Okay. We'll forward up to those slides, and then we'll let you know when we're ready to share our screen. Okay, we're ready whenever you're ready.
Okay, go ahead.
So can you see this, our screen, Molly?
Yep.
Oh, okay, great. Well, hi, everyone. We're pinch hitting a little bit. So this is Allison Hamilton, and I'm actually going to talk about a non-VA hybrid study. As some of you may know, I was involved in the study that Amy just talked about, and now in doing a hybrid in community-based organizations, I've learned a lot and have been in a situation where I've had to expand my thinking based on what I'm learning in these different settings. So the study that I'm working on now is a study designed to decrease HIV incidence among African American serodiscordant couples. So just to give you a little bit of background, African Americans have been affected by HIV more than any other racial ethnic population. For example, in 2012, 47% of those diagnosed with HIV and 43% of those living with diagnosed HIV were African American. As you may know, HIV is mainly spread by sex with an HIV-infected person, but the fact is that very few interventions are geared toward couples. They're more geared toward individuals. Furthermore, very few interventions focus on heterosexual African Americans and their disproportionate HIV risk. Similar to what Amy mentioned, in this case, we do have evidence-based interventions, and you may have heard of the DEBIs from the CDC. But they vary quite a bit in implementation and especially in sustainability. So what we wanted to do in this study was look at the effectiveness of an intervention called IBON, which is a word that means sense in Yoruba. And this is an evidence-based intervention that really attempts to fill the gap for at-risk African-American couples, and its efficacy was demonstrated in a multi-site randomized controlled trial. Well, similar to what Amy described, we're really interested in a balance between studying effectiveness and implementation. So we wanted to look at factors associated with implementation in 10 community-based organizations in two regions in California, Oakland and Los Angeles, both of which are pretty heavily hit by HIV, And we also wanted to look at the effectiveness of the intervention as delivered to an intended 180 couples in these organizations. I could talk at length about the types of things we had to deal with in our resubmissions of this proposal, reflecting what Amy mentioned before about sort of growth in the field and in reviewers' knowledge and just the sophistication of implementation science overall, but that would take us too far afield. But one of the things I did want to mention is that we had to very clearly define what we meant by successful implementation. So how would we know that implementation actually worked in this case? And we define that here as, you can see this sort of combination of effectiveness and implementation. So we wanted to look at the number of couples served, as well as how many cycles of the intervention were completed, as well as delivering the intervention with fidelity and satisfaction with the intervention. What has been a little bit unique about this study is that we were also funded to study sustainability, which was pretty unusual because, of course, during a sustainability period, the researchers really not doing anything. And so we had to make a strong case for why it was important to study sustainability in the context of this R01. And we're also looking at cost effectiveness on a modest scale. So why we chose a type 2 and not a type 1 or a type 3, the intervention did have established efficacy, but it had no effectiveness data in so-called real-world circumstances, which in this case we were considering to be routine care in community-based settings. We really wanted to look at client-level outcomes under less controlled conditions. And we also wanted to evaluate our implementation strategies and tools in order to see what best supported uptake of the intervention across extremely heterogeneous organizational contexts. So for our design, we have a mixed methods evaluation, and it is guided by the program change model, which is a later version of the Simpson transfer model that Amy talked about earlier. So that model itself has gone through a bit of an evolution, and I'll show you that in a minute. For our effectiveness study, we're using a waitlist design where we randomly assign couples to intervention or waitlist, and we're delivering the intervention at two randomly selected organizations per year according to what C. Hendricks Brown has called a randomized rollout implementation or dynamic waitlisted design, and he's written some really great papers about that to enable us to think about what does power mean at an organizational level when your organizational level sample is, in this case, it was 10. So there's really complicated power issues there when you think about that type of sample. And for sustainability, we're doing a 9-month assessment after each organization completes 3 8-week intervention cycles. And here again, we had to define our terms very carefully, and we define successful sustainability as the organization delivering 2 8-week cycles of the intervention with fidelity to the core elements without our involvement. Our conceptual model, as I mentioned, was the program change model, which is an updated version by Simpson of the Simpson transfer model that you saw earlier. So the phased organizational change pretty much remains the same as what you saw before. In terms of going from training to adoption, implementation, and practice improvement. And what's really helpful about this model that we've seen in both of these studies is that there are measures associated with the different components of the model, so you're really able to operationalize these concepts via well-validated instruments in this model. And, in fact, in a recent review of organizational readiness for change instruments, the instruments associated with this model were found to be the most valid instruments of all measures that are out there right now. So here you can see our implementation strategies and tools, which we lined up by each phase of the program change model. So the different tools and strategies we were using in training versus adoption, implementation, and practice improvement. And I think what's not so much reflected here, but what's been very much the case is that there's an iterative cycle of all of these strategies and tools. So even though they appear in one phase and not another, we're finding that we're constantly needing to bring back in, for example, some of the training tools, even though now we're in implementation. We're having sort of another kickoff meeting in a couple of weeks because we had to bring different organizations on board. So it sort of looks nice and neat when you write it all out for a proposal, but when it comes time to actually do it, there's a lot of pulling and crossing of the phases so that you can adjust to what's actually happening during the course of implementation. For our organizational assessment, we did a web-based survey through SurveyMonkey, and that was completed by 100 staff who provide direct client care. And we did this only at baseline. One of the reasons for that is that we didn't actually see a whole lot of change in readiness in the EQUIP study, and that's been held up in other studies as well. So we wanted to just ask the staff one time to complete these measures, which included the survey of organizational function associated with the program change model, Greg Aaron's evidence-based practice attitude scale, the EBPATH, the burnout inventory, as you heard about before. And we also had a couple of questions about the organization's familiarity with treatment of couples. And we conducted semi-structured interviews at pre-baseline, at pre-implementation, and those continue throughout the course of the study. So that amounts to about 50 key stakeholders at the participating organizations. In terms of lessons that we're learning, it's really different, as I mentioned before, to do this type of study in community-based organizations than my experience had taught me previously in conducting these types of studies in VA in a closed healthcare system. We're seeing things at the community level and at the broader external context level that just weren't as they weren't as pressing in the VA studies that I've participated in before. So what we're seeing in these organizations are the heavy impact of competitive economic times, the constantly changing resources and policies related to HIV and its care, changes in medication, funding that's allocated to HIV is changing all the time, sometimes due to state-level issues and sometimes due to federal issues. So these agencies, organizations, face a lot of barriers that are way outside of our purview, but that very much affect implementation. And I'm tempted to say that these issues are even more pronounced in these community-based organizations than what we've seen in VA, at least what's documented in the literature. So in terms of staffing, turnover, funding, time limitations, recruitment limitations, the organizations, like, for example, several that signed on early on are now gone. They just don't even exist as organizations anymore. Or organizations that used to be large are now very small. And they have to respond and adapt to the trends in their funding context that are, like I said, way beyond what we have anything to do with. And also, our study becomes much less of a priority if they say, well, we're going to participate in a PrEP study that provides us X million dollars worth of support for the next 5 years. You know, they're going to prioritize that, understandably so. So then our study sort of has to ebb and flow with the changes that the organizations have to make, literally to survive as community-based organizations. We've also seen tremendous barriers among the couples themselves. These are very, very impoverished individuals for the most part. They have a lot of housing instability, a lot of substance abuse, family dynamics and challenges. There's a lot of resistance to HIV testing. As I mentioned, these are serodiscordant couples, so one member of the couple is HIV positive and the other isn't. And they're just facing a lot of issues that make it very difficult for them to prioritize being involved in a risk reduction intervention that may not be as pressing as making sure that they can eat tomorrow, get their kids to school, have a roof over their head, et cetera. So that has posed a whole batch of challenges for us in terms of recruitment and maintaining people in the intervention. So, combined, these issues have given us a number of scientific challenges. Maintaining the study design has been one of the major challenges, and intervention fidelity and integrity has been something that we're dealing with on a daily basis, pretty much. So what we're looking at now is more a situation of what we've started to call extreme adaptation and variation and really just rolling with the punches as they move along and figuring out how can we deliver the intervention as best we can under these circumstances and pay actually much more attention to implementation because of the compromises that have had to be made in the study design itself. So, similar to the EQUIP study, this takes a lot of people doing very hard work all the time. We're very thankful to the organizations that have stuck in there with us and our fantastic team that makes this happen. Here are the references that I cited, and we have the protocol published in Implementation Science. This is an NIMH-funded R01 that I've been talking about, and as Amy mentioned, it's still ongoing for the next few years. So do we have Mana? Let's not do the poll question.
No, let's Mana.
Do we have Mana, Molly?
Yeah, I think we do. Mana, you should be on the call now, right? Mana, do you have your telephone unmuted? I thought we had got... Mana, it looks like you have muted yourself on the dashboard, so just go under the staff section and click the telephone next to your name, and that will unmute your telephone line. Okay, you seem to be unmuted.
All right.
Excellent. Are you ready to share your screen?
I am.
Okay, you should see that pop up now. And then just click Show My Screen. Perfect. And there you are.
I apologize for the technical difficulties. We've had a lot of snow and ice here, and so I'm not in the same place that I normally would be to do this presentation. I'm going
to
be talking.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Can you go up into full screen mode real quick? Yeah, that one right there.
There.
Perfect. Thank you. We appreciate you pinch hitting during the snowstorm.
So I'm going to be talking about a study of an implementation strategy, a implementation facilitation strategy that was a hybrid three study. Because integrating evidence-based mental health practices and programs into primary care settings improves care, the VA began their primary care mental health integration initiative in 2007. And as part of that initiative, they provided funding for pilot programs, issued a policy directive in 2008 requiring that VA facilities and community-based outpatient clinics of certain sizes implement both co-located collaborative care and care management in primary care clinics. And they also provided some national level support, including consultation and training. Despite these supports, VA facilities were slow to implement these models. And so to apply for the pilot funding in Vision 16, operational managers and implementation scientists partnered to develop an implementation strategy consisting of an external and internal facilitator. Results of applying this strategy to implement primary care mental health integration models was promising, but there had not been time to design and conduct a rigorous evaluation. So we conducted a query-funded service-directed project called Blended Facilitation to Enhance Primary Care Mental Health Program Implementation. Joanne Kirchner was the PI. For this study, facilitators implemented the implementation strategy as a clinical initiative in two other networks to help primary care clinics implement it, and I'll call Primary Care Mental Health Integration, PCMHI for short. We conducted an independent evaluation of this strategy. So the PEERS framework informed both the operationalization of the implementation strategy and our evaluation of it. According to PEERS, successful implementation is a function of the dynamic interaction between organizational context, the nature and type of evidence, and facilitation. PEERS developers suggest that the process of facilitation can address barriers related to organizational context and evidence to promote successful implementation. The implementation strategy we were evaluating included a national expert external facilitator and internal regional facilitators, one in each network. The external facilitator was an expert in implementation facilitation techniques, implementation science, and primary care mental health integration, or PCMHI, models of care. She linked the internal regional facilitators and study clinics to PCMHI program developers, content experts, and implementation resources. She also trained and mentored the internal facilitators to transfer knowledge about PCMHI and implementation facilitation knowledge and skills to them. The internal facilitator was a network employee and was familiar with organizational structures, climates, cultures, and clinical settings within their networks. They worked directly with site-level personnel to help implement PCMHI. One of their roles was to help sites incorporate new initiatives into their PCMHI programs. With the mentoring the external facilitator provided, the internal facilitators became experts in implementation facilitation, and these skills could then be applied to spread PCMHI or implement other evidence-based programs within their network. Facilitators applied multiple implementation interventions to assist study sites. They engaged and supported local change agents. They conducted academic detailing and marketing and provided education. They engaged stakeholders at all levels. They helped sites design programs tailored to their own needs and resources, and they helped them adapt their programs over time. They conducted formative evaluation activities, monitoring implementation, providing feedback to sites, and helping them address implementation challenges as they were identified. They also established communities of practice for PCMHI providers, and they helped sites assess site fidelity to the program they had designed, VA policy, and evidence. And they conducted these activities across all phases of implementation, selecting and using interventions as they were needed. Our evaluation of the implementation facilitation strategy. Was a hybrid 3 design. It was a controlled trial of the implementation strategy. We conducted the study at 8 matched pairs of sites. Comparison sites received national level support only. We used multiple uptake and provider measures across providers and sites. And because of limitations in available data, patient health outcomes were not available, so we assessed proportion of patients receiving PCMHI services. Our study was not a hybrid type 1 study because we were not testing the effectiveness of PCMHI. It was a mandated program, and it was not a type 2 study because we needed more emphasis on the implementation strategy. Again, we were not concerned with effectiveness. Our study design was quasi-experimental. We conducted the study at 16 primary care clinics. 8 clinics, 4 in each of 2 networks, received implementation facilitation, and 8 matched comparison clinics, 4 in each of 2 additional networks. Of the 8 implementation facilitation clinics, we selected 4 sites for intensive case study. We used a consensus matching process because network leadership can influence primary care mental health integration implementation. We matched networks on organizational structure and support for PCMHI. We then asked network mental health directors to identify clinics that would be unable to implement PCMHI without help. We then matched our clinics. We had 3 study aims to test the effectiveness of the strategy we were using versus national support, to assess organizational context, perceptions, and attitudes regarding evidence for primary care mental health programs, and the facilitation process within the context of those findings, and finally, to collect time data on facilitation activities so that we could assess the system cost. We used a mix of qualitative and quantitative methods to evaluate the strategy. I previously mentioned that our study design was guided by the Paris framework. We conducted a primarily qualitative assessment of organizational context and perception of evidence for PCMHI models of care at baseline at all study sites. To assess the facilitation process, we conducted regular individual debriefing interviews with facilitators to document their activities, site barriers and facilitators to implementation, the external facilitators training and mentoring activities with internal regional facilitators, and system level changes that might impact implementation at the local level. We also documented facilitators' time on a weekly basis. At our case study sites, we conducted qualitative interviews with facilitators, VISN, the AMC, and clinic personnel to assess the implementation facilitation process and stakeholders' perception of the process. The REAIM framework guided our evaluation of the effectiveness of the strategy. We used administrative data to assess reach, effectiveness, adoption, implementation, and maintenance. For the implementation dimension, we additionally conducted a qualitative assessment of fidelity and program quality by assessing PCMHI program components sites had implemented, creating structured summaries of site programs, and engaging PCMHI program experts blinded to site and timing to rate the extent to which programs made use of evidence-based strategies were sustainable and would improve the quality of care. They also rated the overall quality of each program, taking all factors into account. Finally, using our qualitative data, we compared implementation at our case study site. So our facilitators reported that the lessons that they had learned were to expect the unexpected. Anything can happen when you're trying to facilitate implementation, and to assess the political landscape early in the process, new policy implementation initiatives can compete for resources. Our evaluation team learned some additional lessons. We learned that also that it's important to understand and monitor the broader policy context. During the study, VA added additional national level support for implementation, and we had to adjust some of the components of our study plan. Also, as we were identifying and recruiting comparison sites, we found that stakeholders at facilities trying to avoid implementation or accountability, and a lot of our smaller facilities were inundated by new plans, new things to implement, and so they sometimes may have been avoiding engaging in research activities, and we found recruitment challenging, though not impossible. We also found it was important to have one person involved across all components of our mixed method study. That maximized the opportunities for interaction between study components and integration of the data. This was our study team. Again, we had our team of facilitators that acted as a clinical initiative. They were blinded to our evaluation, and this is our evaluation.
Great. Thank you so much, Mona. Pardon me. I'm going to turn the screen back over to Amy and Allison now so that we can do the last poll question real quick, and then we will get to the Q&A. So, Amy, you should have that pop up now. I just want to click show my screen.
Yeah. Can you see our screen?
Yep, we are up now. So before we get to the Q&A, we're just going to do one last poll question. So for our attendees, you should see that on your screen at this time. The question is, which implementation science topic should be addressed in a future cyber seminar? And your answer options are hybrid study designs, implementation strategies, conceptual models, and evaluation methods. You may recognize some of these answer options. And it looks like we've had just over half of our audience respond, and answers are still streaming in, so we'll give people more time. You can also make further suggestions when the session closes. A feedback form will pop up on your screen, and we do ask for suggestions for other topics for cyber seminars, and we do read those closely, so feel free to put your input in. Okay, it looks like we've capped off at about two-thirds response rate, so I'm going to go ahead and close the poll and share the results. Looks like people, about 16% are interested in hybrid study designs, 26% implementation strategies, 21% conceptual models, and 37% evaluation methods. So it looks like everybody wants a little bit of something out there. Okay. And do you ladies want to back it up just one slide?
Sure.
Not sure we can.
Yeah, just that left arrow right there. Perfect. Thank you. Okay, so for our attendees, to submit a question or comment for our presenters, just use the question section of your GoToWebinar dashboard. To expand it, click the plus sign next to the word questions. That will open up the dialog box where you can then type your question or comment in. Since we did have three presenters, if it is specifically for one presenter, please specify who it is. And we'll get right into it. Our first question, Allison, this came in during your portion. Did you encounter any difficulties with using the SurveyMonkey for staff? Also, did you use the basic free survey, or did your team purchase the more advanced SurveyMonkey?
So it's important to remember that this is not the study I talked about was not VA, so we don't have in that study as many restrictions as we might have on different options for surveys in VA. So we didn't have any problems using it, and we did buy it, or we, you know, got a license to it so that we could use the analytic tools. So I think we got a year license with access to all of the different tools that it can provide for you.
I believe VA, it's Amy, I believe VA now uses REDCap for surveys. And it stores the data behind a firewall in the VA.
Great. Thank you both for your replies. This next question is directed for everyone, so please each take a shot at it. What were the most useful quality tools in assessing barriers? We can just go in order, Amy, if you want to start.
I mean, for me, I think in EQIP, and I don't know what Allison will say, but in EQIP, I think the most helpful was actually talking to the sites once a month and then taking minutes on those, digesting where the problems were, and then connecting with people with power at the site who could help us overcome those barriers. So to really just hear from the sites on a regular basis was the best way to collect them, you know, writing them down and giving it to us later wasn't something we could really act on quickly. So I thought that was the most helpful. Mm-hmm. What about you, Allison?
In the current study that I talked about, I wish I could say that the measures that we used at baseline were really helpful in identifying barriers, but they weren't so helpful because they weren't tapping into, in retrospect, they weren't tapping into a lot of the dynamics that we have witnessed and had to grapple with since the study started. So I didn't have this in my slides, but looking at just the organizational readiness measures and all the instruments we used alone, things were looking very good. the sites were looking ready, great attitudes toward evidence-based practices, et cetera. And so it seemed like the contexts were very ripe for implementation, but there was a lot that we didn't measure because we didn't know that we needed to measure it that has ended up being much more important. So therefore, I would say that the interviews, and similar to what Amy said, the very frequent contact with people at each site was the most critical in terms of helping us to understand barriers, and it continues to be critical. We have a network of all of our participating sites, and so we hear about barriers from them whenever they want to tell us about them, and then systematically on a monthly basis. So there's really no substitute for talking to the people who are actually trying to make it happen to find out what those barriers are.
Excellent. And Mona, did you have anything you wanted to add to that?
No, except that our study was so different. Our facilitators who were not conducting research, they were just facilitating programs, did exactly that. They were on a regular basis assessing what was happening at the sites and problem solving and helping sites address those barriers. As researchers, we were just looking over their shoulders and documenting the barriers and facilitators they found and what they did to address them.
Thank you very much. This question is also intended for everyone. Any recommendations about funding for future Hybrid 2 studies in the VA and other federal organizations? Would anybody like to kickstart it?
I will do my best. This is Allison. I think that the general trend right now in VA is more toward type 3, like what Mana described. And it's interesting that, you know, there was a pretty consistent level of interest in implementation strategies, which is, of course, at the core of the type 3s. If I were looking to do a hybrid in VA right now, I think it would be a type 3 and not a type 2. I think that beyond VA, there still is, there are opportunities for funding hybrid type 2s and even type 1s at NIH, and just continual growth at NIH in sophistication around implementation research and funding mechanisms correspondingly that can support this type of work. What we've found is that it just means you have to do a bit of education in the proposals around study design and choices that you've made in terms of methods and models and so forth, because it's still growing, sort of generally speaking in the country in this type of work. And so you really have to be careful about whose model you're using and whose version of implementation research you're using, especially between a VA and a non-VA audience. There are some similarities and then there are some differences. So I would say type 2s, maybe aren't quite as prioritized right now in VA as the type 3s.
And it's Amy, I think the beauty of a type 3 right now in VA is it really lends itself to a partnership with operations. Mm-hmm. So you can really think about, similar to what Mana talked about, where you can think about something that VACO is trying to push out but really is not having a lot of success, and you could test two implementation strategies at different sites in order to see which is most successful for uptake and impact of an operations project or something that's being pushed down from VACO. So I think it really lends itself to the new sort of atmosphere right now in VA.
I think that there's a lot of changes going on in the VA right now. A lot of decisions are being made about the new funding landscape and what the QUERY program will be doing. And although the QUERY program will no longer have the SDP and RRP mechanisms, which was where some of the Hybrid 2 studies lighted, HSR&D, we're being told that HSR&D will be funding implementation studies, mm-hmm. And that's where hybrid 2s and hybrid 1s will go. They're including, now it may take a while for this to be a smooth process, but they are including implementation scientists on review panels. They're training the other brief trainings to the other reviewers, so they have at least some understanding of hybrid studies, but we've been told that implementation science is alive and well, and that HSR&D will that those kinds of applications can go to HSR&D.
Thank you. The next question: how long do such analyses typically take? Is there a way to work through implementation models quickly to support VACO's need in shorter turnaround time than a typical HSR&D study?
Well, I think there is beauty in an implementation study that you can actually glean information throughout the study, and you can actually write papers or white papers or report to headquarters throughout, because the study you don't have to wait till the end. Wouldn't you agree with that, Allison?
Yeah, I mean, if that's the design that you've selected, you have to pretty much line up your methods to support a more, at least one aspect of a more efficient approach to analysis. So
yeah.
It might be that you don't do all of the analyses you would want to do at a given time, like mid-implementation,
right.
But you would still want to set up your methods and your data collection to facilitate more rapid approaches to turning around interim results in order to inform implementation, if that's the type of design that you selected. So that's more typical of a type two. And, you know, there's definitely interest in and emphasis on turning around as much knowledge about effectiveness and implementation quickly, more so than ever.
Yeah.
So to make sure that, you know, we still do things systematically, but at the same time, and with rigor, but at the same time, sort of equip ourselves to share knowledge earlier, you know, given the circumstances of the particular study.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Did you want to add to that at all, Mana?
Thank you.
Okay. Well, that is the final pending question at this time. I would like to give any of you the opportunity to make concluding comments to our audience if you'd like. Amy or Allison, do you have anything you'd like to add?
No, I mean, just, you know, feel free to get in touch with us if you have any questions based on what you've heard today. And, you know, we all provided bibliographies of papers that are really helpful to read to learn more about these types of studies, not only papers from our particular studies, but just from the field in general. So, you know, it's exciting that the field of implementation science has gotten to this point where we do have really interesting and innovative types of designs and then considerations that go along with those, and it's very interesting and helpful for us to learn that evaluation methods have kind of risen to the top as a key interest for the audience, and that's something that we can follow up on and talk to colleagues on and try to get a cyber seminar prepared on that topic. So really appreciate that feedback.
Great. And Mana, did you want to add anything?
No. Well, except that when we, when Allison and Amy and I planned this presentation, this set of presentations originally, our hope was that there are a lot of presentation, kind of didactic presentations on these issues, and our hope was that by presenting some particular case examples, it might be helpful, and we hope that it has been today.
Wonderful. Well, we really appreciate the three of you lending your expertise to the field, and of course, thank you to our attendees for coming with us. You will receive a follow-up email 2 days from now with a link leading directly to the recording of this session and the handout, so feel free to share that with any of your colleagues. As you exit out of today's presentation, please wait just a second while the feedback form pops up on your screen. Please do take just a moment to fill out those feedback questions. We do look closely at your suggestions, and it helps us plan which topics and cyber seminars to support. So once again, thank you everyone for joining us, and this does conclude today's HSR&D cyber seminar. Have a nice day.
Thanks, Molly.
Thank you.
Thank you.